Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Trevor from Halifax calling in to say that I support Creative Control on Patreon because I think long-form arts journalism is a crucial part of music culture and there's simply not enough of it out there today. Vish is a master interviewer, he lands great guests, and he has his finger on the pulse of the ever-changing music landscape both here in Canada and abroad. For all of these reasons and many more, I think you should support Creative Control on Patreon too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do. And now he has me on the record saying that.
John Linnell is a multi-instrumentalist, composer, and lyricist based in New York City. Along with John Flansburgh, Linnell co-founded They Might Be Giants in 1982, launching one of the most successful and prolific music partnerships in history and releasing 22 albums to date. Since their inception, They Might Be Giants have sold millions of records, been nominated for a Tony Award, have won 2 Grammy Awards, including one for their signature song, Boss of Me, which was the theme for the popular TV show Malcolm in the Middle. They also perform the theme music for The Daily Show, and they continue to be a popular touring band. Their latest release is Book, which is both an excellent new album and also an artful hardcover book showcasing the band's lyrics and unique typography as designed by Paul Sayre and accompanied by the beautiful photography of Brian Carlson. Book, the record, and the book were released on October 29th, 2021, and prompted John and I to have a conversation all about If Dogs Run Free, the making of and ideas behind Book, the dark whimsy of They Might Be Giants, and next year marking the band's 40th anniversary, narrative songwriting, playing late-night talk shows, electric typewriters, If Day for Winnipeg, politics in Canada and America, The Larry Sanders Show, and Scott Thompson of the Kids in the Hall, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is the 646th episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented John Linnell from They Might Be Giants, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Interest me, it's a never-ending litany of pain and ennui. This waking nightmare is driving me mad, and I wish I could remember the dream that I had. When I'm awake, I know all that I see, and remember it with photographic accuracy. Hi, John, how's it going?
It is going well. How are you, sir?
I'm well. It's nice to speak with you. It's an honor to speak with you, first of all, or second of all. I already said hello. Second of all, where in the world are you today?
I'm upstate New York, in my little getaway up here, which is why I'm recording this interview on my iPhone, because I don't have I'm not in my fancy pro studio down in New York City, where I spend most of my time. But I'm up here now. Mainly, I have these dogs with me, and rather than walk around the city and pick up after them in plastic bags, I think it's nicer to have them just run around outside and be free. So, and really, it's on behalf of the dogs that I'm here.
Well, I don't know. It sounds like it's on behalf of the dogs. It sounds like it's more on behalf of you, so you don't have to be picking up.
Well,
the poop.
That's an interesting point. No, I think we both of us benefit. I think the dogs like it better up here, and indeed, I do appreciate the freedom that I enjoy.
Well, I hope your fellow hikers and neighbors appreciate your freedom as well. All the poop lining the walkways. No, that sounds great. What are you, like near New Paltz or something? That's what I think of when I think of upstate New York.
Now I'm a little further up. Yeah, upstate is massive. I'm up near Albany.
Oh, okay, cool. Nice. Yeah. Well, it's lovely to chat with you, as I say, and we're here to talk about this very ambitious project. I feel like most of They Might Be Giants projects are fairly ambitious. Is that wrong? Am I wrong? Do you feel like that?
I would say we have sort of we're very accustomed to our own level of ambition. We don't tend to calibrate it. Actually, I should say when we made our first children's record, we didn't really have a clear idea of how big of a deal it was going to wind up being. We sort of felt like we were goofing around. And in a way, that was the key to the success of the kids record was that the first kids record was that I think we were really enjoying ourselves making it. We weren't thinking that it would have much of an impact. And as a result, the sort of carefree quality came through, I think. But with the stuff that we do for adults, yeah, we're generally at about the same level of uptightness about making it come out nice and trying not to sound too uptight, you know.
Yeah.
Straining to not sound uptight.
That's the blurb. That's the blurb on Book, by the way, for those of you, those who haven't picked it up yet.
Exactly. Now,
the first children's album, as I recall, was that the one that won you a Grammy Award?
No, we got a Grammy for the, I think it was the second of the Disney DVDs that
I'm
came
sorry.
Out with.
Okay.
That's okay.
I mean, I guess the Disney thing in my head, I conflated Disney with children's album, but all I was getting at there, because you referenced the unexpected success of the children's albums, and also
yes.
because you were treating it seems to me, like more of a lark. And isn't that interesting when the thing that you're not uptight about transcends your expectations? That's fairly, I find that happens a lot. The thing you're like, yeah, I put 3 seconds of thought into this. Now everyone's talking about it. Whereas the thing I spent a year deliberating over, or, you know, That's the way the world is these days, I feel like, with social media. Like the person who writes, like, hamburgers are good, 50,000 retweets. And if someone else is like, I feel like the policy making, and then, you know, it does okay. But anyway, yeah. Do you find that? Isn't that weird that the thing you care the least about?
I think that's, yeah. I think it's, you're right that it's true. It's manifestly true in, you know, social media now. But it's always been true of the creative act. I think that often your best ideas are the ones that come very quickly and sort of naturally and just feel like easy for other people to digest because they just came out so naturally, I think is often the case. I would say that occasionally you labor over something and the work that you put into it pays off. And so that sort of balances out that thing because it is often worthwhile. We've had songs, for example, that we revised multiple times where each revision was an improvement, or we've done multiple takes of a song where we notice, oh, this part is working, that, you know, like we put thought and work into it and that actually does make it better. But I think you try and strike a balance and we actually do both of those things. We have like the tossed off masterpiece and the, you know, and the incredibly labored over what have you.
Yeah. No, I feel it. I feel that, and I feel like that's true of the band as well. So speaking of ambitious projects, potentially labored over projects, let's talk about Book, because it is not simply an album. It is, there's a book.
There's a book.
It's aptly named.
Yes.
And I wonder when the, let's just to get people on the same page, no pun intended, where did the concept of a book come from, and when did you conceive of it?
Right.
It's 2021 as we're speaking, but it seems to me that this was took some time, perhaps. Can you talk about those things? Why and when?
Why and when? Well, when was after we'd begun writing and demoing songs for this project, which is our usual thing. We come off the road and we start writing right away. And we often are writing kind of in advance of, you know, there's often songs that wind up on an album that were written two cycles ago, for example. So that was the when. The book concept came in the middle of it. And then the why, I think you'd have to ask my partner, because it was really his inspiration was to come up with a package. You know, I think he was thinking, well, let's do something different. What kind of, he's generally the one in charge of the art direction of our work. And I think he felt like this should really be a package. We could actually do something, make a physical object, not, you know, you can buy the album separately from the book if you want to. But more and more, it seems like there's something very ephemeral seeming about putting out online music as a download or whatever, that it doesn't feel as tangible as stuff from our early lives. So this seemed like a nice way to make an object that you could actually have and wasn't just a little, you know, CD package. It was like a full 12-inch vinyl sized book with a hardcover. And I think John had come across the photographer's Brian Carlson's work. At some point he discovered Brian Carlson and got in touch with him and said, you know, we'd like to maybe do a collaboration. What, you know, we'd be interested in contributing photos to a book that contains music and also has lyrics. And that was sort of the very, just the germ of the idea. And Brian, of course, was very, very into it, which was great, because I think that his photographs do feel in some ways visually like an analog of some of the stuff that we do, just in a very vibey way. I think there's something about his pictures that remind me of the way some of the songs make you feel. But that's a very subjective thing, obviously.
Well, no, I was going to say there's a, if I may be reductive, I mean, there's always been a dark whimsy, if
yep.
you will.
Dark whimsy.
Yeah, dark whimsy. Blurb that as well. This
it.
Is just whole things blurbs. We're
it's
just coming up with little stickers
factory.
For that. So there's always been a dark whimsy to They Might Be Giants. And then when I look at Brian's photos here, and I wasn't familiar with Brian's work. It's really beautiful. I love the photographs. Each one to me, you know, I don't mean to be stereotypical or cliche, but each photo, there's a story in each photo.
Absolutely.
And when it's it's sort of connected to a song, for example, there's the opening song, Synopsis for Latecomers, has this line, "Who ate the babies?" That's dark. That's dark. And it's not really whimsical. It's dark. Well, babies make you think, oh, babies. I like babies. But then who ate the babies? That's bad. But then you look at the accompanying photo. I don't know if you remember this from the book. It's probably been some time since you had a good look at it. Maybe
I
don't know.
I can open up my copy and follow along.
Yeah, please do. The accompanying photo it seems to be a refuse on the street, trash on the street. And there seems to be a child covered in plastic, as though it were dead.
And yes.
Yeah, so I'm awful. Like, oh, so like I'm reading the lyrics and then I'm listening to the song, which has a very martial beat, kind of, you know, like a parade or something, or almost a military procession. And then you've got this photo of a child that's clearly been like, you know, the coroner's drape, if you will. And I'm like, oh my God, this is dark. But is that what you're kind of getting at, the complimentary nature?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we tend to avoid what John sometimes refers to as CSAY in our videos. And I think that was the case here. We didn't want a book that is just illustrations of our lyrics. So that was, it is certainly a serendipitous relationship, because I don't think Brian had listened to our song or was particularly taking photographs to try and go along with the song. Yeah. So I think that it's more a case where the photo was chosen because it went along with the vibe. Now, all right, I'm looking at the book. Oh yeah, I see that you're correct that photo does go along with the first track on the album.
Are you just fact checking me right now? I know what I'm saying.
I know. I needed to refresh my memory.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. But you see where I'm coming from, right? You hear the line and you read the line. Who ate the babe? Do you know what that's even a reference to? Who ate the babies? Do you want to characterize this song?
The song is a kind of a, as you, I'm sure you know this from reading the lyrics or hearing the song, that it's about a sort of, there's been a catastrophe and someone in a kind of, you know, position of authority is trying to reassure everybody that everything that can be done to manage the situation is being done, but in that typically kind of not very reassuring way. And that's it's you know, that's the basic outline of the song, and then it's a list of unbelievable catastrophic events.
I get what you were saying earlier about how book as a physical product seems to fly in the face of the fleeting consumption we're all used to right now, you know, like intangible stuff. But otherwise, do you feel like lyrically, like, sorry, the actual manifestation of book as a record, as a book, seems to be a comment in itself about contemporary life. What about lyrically? Were these songs written in relation to the pandemic and what we learned about the pandemic?
Good question. I've been asked that before and I had to think about it. In the case of this song, I think that I wrote the song, before the pandemic began. Although we finished the, recording, we were a little ways into the pandemic by that time. And it may be that the choice, well, actually, you know, I have to say, like, it was the other guys in the band who was Flansburgh mainly, who said that he wanted to put this first on the album, and I my response was like, are you sure? I don't know, this doesn't feel like an album opener to me, but he kind of felt like it was just sending the whole thing in a completely different direction from the typical They Might Be Giants album, that it just feels like a very different way to start the album.
Does it generally, beyond the fact that a book accompanies it, to you, does it feel like a different They Might Be Giants album per se?
I think that in general, it sounds a lot like us, you know. And I would say that's true of almost everything we do is that it's, I would say it's identifiably us. But as, you know, as you can imagine, like we're very close to the project. So I don't even sometimes know what we sound like. I don't know. For example, if I heard a parody of our music, I wouldn't necessarily recognize it because to me, this is just what we do. And it's not, it's a bit like the way you have a clear sense of what all your friends look like, but when you look in the mirror, you don't necessarily feel the same way about your own face. Mm. You know that you don't know how to characterize your own appearance,
right? Fair enough.
I think as readily as I think that's true in the case of our band. That I don't know what we sound like or what we. I don't know what we mean to other people exactly, except what I hear from people say. But
yeah.
But that's a very secondhand impression.
Well, when I think of the contemporary resonance of some of the songs, I mean, we've been all dealing with a situation that has heightened our recognition of where our leadership has failed. And
sure.
So that's where I hear like there's the existential stuff that I feel like it occurs within your music sometimes. But then there's more, there's some critical, like the existential stuff here. There's a song called Brontosaurus. And I thought, oh, well, this is about the extinction of humankind. And I maybe drew too fine a line between the dinosaur and human beings, but that's how it feels these days. A lot of existential angst. The song I Broke My Own Rule features a lyric, jump from the top of the absence of responsibility and float into emptiness, which to me, that's like a lot of what kind of criticisms we have right now about our lot in life has to do with people abdicating their responsibility.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can speak to that a little bit about that song. I would say I like everybody's interpretations of all our stuff because I think they're intentionally open-ended and it's good if it suggests all sorts of things. That's actually a good result. But for my own part, I would say that I Broke My Own Rule is really more of a personal song about failing to meet your own standards and that kind of maybe just to return to the theme of being uptight, like the idea that you set standards for yourself and then there's this heartbreaking thing where you realize nobody else maybe even cares, but you didn't execute, you know, something in the way that you normally do and you feel like, you know what I mean? There's a kind of a sense of
this
like,
is how I feel all the time. Yeah. This is how I feel every day. I'm like, what am I doing? Why do I do it? Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's really what that one's about is that sort of, you know, like for example, I have an obsession with keeping the kitchen counter clean and it drives me crazy when I fail to do that. Like I'm, you know, I come into the kitchen, I realize like I've left a mess and I'm the one who's usually the kind of, you know, doctrinaire person about not doing that. So I'm like, oh my God, no, you know, but that's just a very narrow and personal thing that I have about this song. And I like the idea that it, you know, that it means more than one thing.
Well,
but
I do think like, again, contemporary resonance, I think we all are having this reckoning, like, are we too hard on ourselves? There's a heightened recognition.
Okay.
There's a heightened recognition of people's self-awareness and anxiety about themselves and how they fit in the world. So that's a very interesting, I appreciate you articulating your perspective on this song because I viewed it as maybe someone talking, one of you, I suppose, speaking to external failures. But you're describing something that a lot of us are going through, this sort of, what do they call it these days? Imposter syndrome these days. I think they've been
imposter syndrome. Yeah. Absolutely.
So there's stuff like that circulating. So there's a self-awareness there is I guess what you're saying.
I suppose. Yeah. I mean, I would say in general, John and I don't write broad social kind of criticisms or analyses, you know, or we're not trying to, and we tend to write. I mean, obviously we're also not writing about our personal lives in an autobiographical way.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We're kind of loath to try and write a confessional song, I would say. I like it when other people do that, but I don't particularly want to do that myself.
Is that for privacy purposes, so to speak?
No, I think it's more like I just don't feel comfortable writing, oh, I got up this morning and blah, 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 you know, and having it be about me. I really like writing fiction, I guess. Maybe that's the shorthand way of saying it. I like the idea of you create a character and that person is the narrator of your song or you know, that or maybe it's a song about something going on, but you're just describing, you're telling a story, and I like storytelling. So that's kind of my feeling about it. You know, I know that in even in contemporary fiction, there's a strong tendency for people to, you know, like the, what's his name? Knausgård writing of where you really are just detailing your personal life. And again, I'm interested when other people do it, but I don't feel like that's my thing.
Yeah. No, that's fair. That's fair enough. You shouldn't feel bad about that.
I don't feel bad. but thank you. Thank you for that.
Your band has been together, almost 40 years, it feels like. Is that right? It feels like.
Yep.
I don't know where it feels like that, but I, in my foot, I can tell. No.
Yeah.
Is that right? Next year? Is that right?
That is right. And I would say the opposite. To me, it doesn't feel like 40 years. But it is actually chronologically almost 40 years, which is completely nuts.
That is nuts.
But
because I'm 43, so that means I was 3 years old. I just was doing some math for us, John, and I was 3, and you had a band, and that band and me were both still around. That's good.
It is good. That's good. I'm glad that that's true.
I'm pointing this out because it's fascinating to me that you still, again, you haven't delved into your personal self-doubt, but this notion that this song that we were just talking about is a manifestation of you and your thoughts, right? So
sure,
even if you
create, with
fiction, I mean, when people create characters, those characters are based on things they know and feel, right? So
that's
they're
true.
Part of them,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So all I'm getting at there is 40 years in, you still have this, it's a combination, I assume, of humility, a little bit of self-doubt, but that's, what more can you prove at this point is what I'm getting at? 40 years of being in a top-tier band, you're doing okay, I would think. Don't you feel that most days?
I like writing songs, and John does too. I think that's the thing that drives us. And it would be a shame if we started to feel like we weren't any good at it, or we'd exhausted all the good ideas. But I guess we are either deluding ourselves and we're just carrying on. You know, Randy Newman said something about that. It's like there's nobody there to tell you like, just stop, just give up, man. You're done, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is certainly the case that other artists, almost all of them, and the ones that I admire, do a lot of their best work early on in their lives. So I guess, I'm grateful that anybody is still enjoying what we're doing. And we obviously do. We go out and play and people show up. And so,
I've had the record on in the kitchen. So the family hears it. And my wife is like, this is great. She just was really enjoying, the songs.
That's nice.
Yeah. So like it's still, very powerful and really, you know, artistically, it's great. It's great. So you're doing well is all I'm getting at. Is that I just wanted for what it's worth from me in Canada, you're doing well. Now we talked briefly about Brian Carlson, and I want to ask you a little bit, as much as you know, because I appreciate you suggesting that maybe your partner John might know more about sort of the arts, the art concepts and the nuts and bolts of how things happen. So,
sure.
But I do want to ask about the type is just as significant to the actual book. I want to talk about Paul Sayre in a moment, but just back to Brian Carlson for a second. You suggested that John, your partner in They Might Be Giants, John, it's confusing. You're both named John. I just want everyone listening. I know you're John. It's fine. John, did he reach out to Brian? Was Brian a fan of the band? Do you have any knowledge of that, how that conduit of activity began?
I can tell you that John reached out to Brian. I don't, I've never met Brian actually.
Oh, you've never met him.
Know,
oh, okay.
I've never met him, so I don't know what his obviously he was agreeable to this project, and that's unfortunately that's the extent of what I know about him personally. But I obviously I'm very much a fan of his work. Yeah. So
did John and Brian discuss, like I said, I put a heavy hand on how one image I thought connected to a song. They don't all do that necessarily, but I mean, at the same time, there was probably intent in placing certain photos by certain writing. Is that true?
I would say that was John Flansburgh. Those were his choices. And maybe to some extent Paul Sayre, because I know that he was involved. I actually don't know this, but I think Paul Sayre has done a lot of package design for us in the past, and so he may have been involved in those sorts of decisions. But mainly, you know, Brian mainly was just contributing his work.
I see. Okay.
And we were, as far as I'm aware,
he ostensibly said, here's a portfolio, if you will. Here's a group of photos that I think are strong, and then probably. So basically, everyone, they put them together. Do you know if there was intent to like a connection?
I appreciate that you're recreating
with my hands,
smoke filled room.
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm using. Like, people can't see
there
this.
There they were.
I'm gesticulating
there
with my
were.
Hands, and it is a little. I'm kind of jazz hands. It's just so people at home or wherever you're listening get a sense of it. But back to what I was getting at there. I'm sorry if I'm rambling or struggling to articulate it. But basically, I'm wondering. To your knowledge, is there intent between the placement of the photos as they relate to not only the songs, but in some cases, as people will discover, the typeset is in itself a design.
Yes.
It's a design. Yes. It's different each page. It's not, you know.
That question I can answer for you.
Okay, here we go. Now we're cooking with gas.
Yes. The answer to your question is yes, there was intent.
Well, that was brief. That's it.
You were expecting a longer answer because you lifted your coffee cup up to your mouth like, okay, I can take a break now.
I have my,
and John's going to talk for like a minute about how this all came together.
Yeah, I have my Late Show with David Letterman mug for those.
Oh, look at that.
You guys did that show, didn't you? How many times did you do the Letterman show?
Well, we did Letterman a number of times, but then it kind of quickly morphed for us into the Conan show, and we actually did Conan about a million times.
Yes, that's right.
So that was the main thing we wound up doing was like countless numbers of Conan appearances.
Conan can you see behind me to my here? Look, I'll do this. Look over here. You see that little poster of Conan?
Oh yeah, I do.
Yeah, so that's from the what's it called? The legally prohibited from being funny on television tour 2010. So I attended in Toronto at Massey Hall.
Cool.
Yeah. So Conan's big for me.
That's awesome. And who was the opening act at that? Do you remember? Was it?
I don't know that I can't think of who that was. Sorry, this is going back 11 years. I feel like perhaps the band opened up. Like I don't remember why. Were there opening acts? Were you?
No. I just know it was. Now I'm completely blanking his name. But this is really talented guy who does. Why am I forgetting his name? That's ridiculous. Anyway, I think he was the opening act for a lot of that.
Okay,
tour.
Yeah, there's a chance there was an opener, but it was a bit of a blur. But I remember the show distinctly and Conan coming up all the way up to the balcony. And I mean, when is the last time you guys got to do a late night talk show? Do you still get to do those opportunities come up?
They do. I mean, it's obviously been sort of interrupted. We actually were booked to go out to LA and do one of them during the before the pandemic, and that unfortunately got blown out. But yeah, I'm sure we're gonna do more.
Do you like that? Like, I feel like one of the great fortunes for your band is that comedy people get it. That seems to be a thing. Is that? Do you agree? Like, I feel like you guys are in the realm of comedy. Would you say?
I would say that we are comedy adjacent. what was the show? We did one of those shows where we had John Hodgman come on and sort of narrate the middle bit of the song we were performing. And he's a good friend. And so it felt like, this is the kind of thing, like we're very comfortable in that environment.
Do you have any sense of like, you're funny and the songs are also very heartfelt and sincere, but why? Do you have any sense of why comedians in particular gravitate towards the band?
I think that we're not trying to act cool. That's probably the main reason we're not like pretending like, oh yeah, I don't ever smile. You know, you know what I mean? That's pretty much all it takes, I guess. You know, it's like a lot of bands have funny lyrics. I think the Smiths had funny lyrics.
Absolutely. I do think there's a perception that when people are musicians anyway, are funny, that they view what they're doing as some sort of novelty, or they get tagged as such.
Right.
Which I always
that's the risk. I mean, that's the obviously that's the one thing that makes people shy, is they don't want to be considered a joke. And then there are bands who are just going for it, you know, being completely ridiculous, and they are comedy, and that's nice. I probably have a certain amount of that nervousness about being perceived as a joke, that, and I think John feels the same way, that we kind of take ourselves a little too seriously, even though we don't want to be some heavy thing, you know, to lay a heavy trip on other people. We want people to enjoy it and have it be fun, but we also kind of maybe are a little bit taking ourselves too seriously.
Well, you have to take yourself seriously. You got to get stuff done. And then if it's funny,
absolutely,
if it happens to be something funny, all the funny stuff, people take it very seriously. Conan O'Brien seems like one of the hardest, incessantly just working hard on everything he does. I think he's very serious about being funny. So I think maybe you are very serious about being funny, witty. You know, you put a lot of thought, and the sound is very unique. So I think that's good.
Right. Well, I think that the thing about a comedian is if they are not funny for any extended period of time, they're not doing their job. They're failing. And we are allowed to be not funny. We give ourselves permission to be not funny for probably most of the time.
Yeah.
So we're not, you know, we have the freedom to just be creepy or whatever.
Mission accomplished. Yeah. It's very creepy as well, just so people aren't confused. Now, I want to ask about the typeset. As I said, Paul Sayer,
yes,
is involved in this process. You mentioned there was intent in all regards, but there's a particular company and typeset involved in this book. Is that right?
That is correct. And I can give you the background, because I was alive when the IBM Selectric was still a very exciting and seemingly new piece of technology, although apparently it was introduced in the early 1960s, I think. Mm. But when I was in high school, which was in the late 70s, it was still considered this incredibly cutting-edge thing. And there were places that we visited. John and I both worked on the high school newspaper together, so I was aware of the Selectric going to the printing house and doing all this stuff, you know, getting stuff typeset, but also being able to use this typewriter there. And then I think they had one at the church in our town. So you do your church newsletter on the IBM Selectric. So just to explain, it was an electric typewriter, which was not a new invention, but the new part was that it had a replaceable type head, which was a ball that had all of the different letters arranged in a circle, 360 degrees around this ball. And the machine, as you typed on it, would lift the ball up and snap it into the correct position and bash it against the page in a tiny fraction of a second. And the idea behind it was, you know, instead of the traditional electric or manual typewriter, which had a series of hammers that had different letters, one on each hammer. So the idea of the ball was that you could actually remove the ball and replace it with a different ball with a different font on it. And this was absolutely revolutionary for a typewriter, that you could change the typeface on an electric typewriter. We all thought it was the coolest thing we'd ever seen.
Human beings are pretty magical creatures. They come up with interesting ideas, don't they?
Yeah. It's a great mechanism.
So what is the current status in terms of frequency of use for this type of typewriter, the IBM?
Yeah, I think it's obsolete now officially, but like so many other obsolete technologies, it's embraced by certain, you know, cultists and fetishists, and Paul Sayer obviously is one of those people. He just got a hold of one and went completely to town. And I also think this may be somewhat clear to people who are, you know, checking out the typography in the book, that there's a reference to the scene in the movie The Shining where Jack Nicholson is starting to lose his mind and is typing the same sentence over and over again and arranging it in all sorts of aesthetic and artistic ways on the page. And there's a moment where Shelley Duvall, who plays his wife, comes across it. And it's one of the most terrifying and weird parts of the movie because you just think, oh no, you know, this is all he's been doing all the time he's supposedly been working. He's actually just been typing this one sentence over and over again. I think
all work and no play make Jack a dull boy. Is that
the sentence? Yeah. Yeah. And I think Paul Sayre was actually conscious of that when he was working because he spent a lot of time on this project and he had a wife and a child who were probably being neglected in the background while he was doing it.
Well, yeah, some of the typing, as I say, is fairly straight ahead, but then every once in a while, it is touched by madness. I will say that. I'm like, this was clearly written at the Overlook Hotel or something. Like, something's not right here. And typing over the type, but it's very captivating and it keeps you very engaged, I will say.
Yeah. Paul's a big fan of distressed type and chopped up things. And he did a previous album cover for us where he sliced up all the typeset stuff and kind of rearranged it and distressed it. And so that's one of the things he's interested in.
Well, I don't mean to go too far down a dystopian rabbit hole, but this seems to be the tone of the conversation, so it's appropriate. No, there's a song, there's actually some Canadian content in a sense that I wanted to get to before we run out of time. And the song is If Day for Winnipeg.
Oh, yeah.
So do you want to talk about, do you have a sense of where that song sort of came from? And I mean, do you want to even take a crack at explaining what If Day was?
I can't fully explain it, that song was penned by Mr. Flansburgh.
I see. Should I just give a little bit of historical background just so people get it?
Sure. Yeah. You can probably say it better than me.
Well, so to my understanding, If Day was a simulated invasion of Canada by the Nazis that took place in February of 1942. So the city organized a simulation of what it might be like if Nazi Germany invaded Winnipeg in particular, and they staged like a firefight between like the Canadian troops and volunteers and people who were pretending to be Germans. And and so the song suggests, as I recall, that If Day is not simply for Winnipeg anymore, that it might be something that other places might contemplate, such a simulation, I think. Again, that's my interpretation. What would you like to say about that, if you could say anything?
Well, I guess I would add that my guess is that in Flansburgh's mind, it's no longer a simulation, that there's sort of a suggestion that it's maybe gotten more real. Or that the idea that some bad, you know, anti-democratic events are actually happening all over the place. And you know, so that's the thrust of it. I think.
So the Winnipeg thing is just, this is just a fascinating historical footnote that the city of Winnipeg in Canada decided to do this. But to your point, I mean, I don't know what is it like being an American these days, John? I mean, the last 5-6 years in particular must be, it must have been difficult.
It's, I would say, feels very unprecedented. And I was a kid during, you know, Watergate. And so I probably had a very different, perspective on the world at that time. But my memory was at that time, we felt like, the government is full of bad guys and, it's weird. But then we kind of, you know, with Nixon resigning and everything, we kind of felt like, oh, well, he couldn't get away with it because you can't do that. You know, you can't commit crimes and get away with it.
But that's not the case anymore. That's not the case anymore, right?
I think that it still has yet to be seen, but we see much more things that would have frightened even Nixon, I think, have happened just this year. So it's, we're still waiting to find out how that's all gonna shake out, you know? And you're right. It's scary and weird. I sometimes had this fantasy that like other places like Canada were immune to this. And then I remember you had this mayor of Toronto who was a complete disaster.
Rob Ford. That's right.
Yeah.
And his brother is the premier of Ontario.
Mm-hmm, yep,
it is,
yep.
Which is for American listeners, that would be the equivalent of governor, I guess, yep, for a state. And one of the reasons we moved to a different, this is questionable logic, but we moved to Alberta, which is actually further right. But it actually had broken like a decades long streak of conservative governments by electing in Canada, we have the New Democratic Party, which is like the furthest left of, we have a Liberal Party that's like in the federal power, like here.
Yeah.
But there's every province has its own premier. So they just had an NDP premier for the first time ever. And then they swung the next election, they swung the furthest right they could go with this new party. It's not even the Conservative Party.
Right.
So, but my wife's family's here and jobs beckon. So we thought, well, elections, what are you supposed to do? Like, you know, every, God, you live in New York.
Yeah.
What kind of governor did you just have?
I know. Like it's, I know. Yeah.
It's embarrassing and difficult.
It is, yeah, exactly those things. I suppose that the climate generally, and this seems to be true everywhere, is this sort of chaotic swinging. The pendulum is sort of flapping around rather than just even swinging in a steady periodic way. It's like wildly, you know, flipping back and forth in a chaotic way. I was just reading apparently in France there's now a new farther right alternative to the Le Pen family.
Yeah.
And they are getting a lot of traction and basically threatening the what I thought was the far right in France.
Yeah, there's no one's happy. I mean, this polarization that we all are living through is obviously going to lead to, it's going to manifest itself in these wild swings of opinion and distress and unhappiness, which sucks. But I don't want us to end on such a rough note. Do you feel like there's some inherent optimism in this book project? Like, do you feel like that's the case?
Yeah. I do. I think it obviously was a good idea because we sold a bunch of them and it's a good, you know. A lot of the other thing that's weird and new in our situation and in everybody in the arts situation is that we are seeing more and more that there's a kind of crowdsource. There's some version of crowdsourcing going on so that we have people who are willing to spend more money really helping to support the project so that it can remain going and be more freely available for those people who are just more casual or passive listeners. So this book is an example of that. It obviously costs more than a normal album, but if enough people buy it, then we can just keep doing this. And I think I have to credit John Flansburgh. He's been very, very smart about imagining ways to keep going. And you know, I mean, there was a time like 200 years ago where you had to get a patron, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
you had to put on your powdered wig and go bow in front of your patron in order to keep your career going as an artist. So maybe there's a little bit of that coming back.
Oh, no, it's totally coming back. By the way, everyone should visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to support the show. Yeah, no, sorry, just joking. Well, I'm not joking. Please do. No, it's true. It's a weird time, but I did notice that a long list of thank yous at the end of book. So these are people you engage in some sort of crowdfunding to get this book.
Those are the people who make us possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're like public television now.
You are a lot like public television, actually. No, I'm just kidding. So on that note, touring behind book, is that something foreseeable? Like, can you imagine actually going out on the road and playing shows right now?
Yes, we're scheduled to go out again in next March, and we've already canceled we've actually postponed all the dates twice so far that were supposed to happen in 2020.
Oh man, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's okay, you know. We're
I mean, it makes sense.
We're soldiering on. And you know what? Then speaking of optimism, the nice thing is that most people held on to their tickets.
Oh,
they did not.
Good.
They were welcome to get refunds, but they decided to keep the ticket and wait for the rescheduled date to come around. And they've waited very patiently now for more than a year. So we're looking forward to it happening. Obviously, it'll be under different circumstances. I imagine we'll have either a vaccination ID required or mask wearing or both.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure how we're going to work it, but we want the shows to be safe. And
Who's to say what March of 2022 is really going to be like?
Yes,
I guess we sort of play it by ear, but I appreciate that you're already contemplating protocols. As I alluded to some time ago, 2022 marks the 40th anniversary of They Might Be Giants. So you've got these
That's
tour
right.
dates. Any other plans per se to commemorate? I can't tell if you two would really be into recognizing such a milestone. But at the same, because of the darkness but there's whimsy. We've established that. So is it something you would acknowledge and do something for,
sure.
per se?
Well, the hilarious thing is that this tour, the 2020 tour was meant to be the 30th anniversary of our third album, Flood, which is probably still our most popular one. And so we'd rehearsed the entire album, and we're preparing, and we actually got a little ways into playing songs from that album before the tour got cut short. So that was already an anniversary, but yeah, we've been waiting so long that another anniversary, as you point out, has already rolled around. It's fine. I love anniversaries. I think the main thing is that we don't like the idea of maybe leaning too hard on the retrospective element, because we feel like we are an ongoing concern, and we're very forward looking. We want to imagine our own future, and we're not ready to be lowered gently into the grave yet.
Well, I mean, usually what happens these days is people will say, "Oh, there's a milestone year coming up. We got to reissue records. We got to, deluxe editions of things." That's kind of where my mind was going in terms of projects beyond touring. I just wondered is there anything in the works in that, like something, I mean, book?
No.
We
don't have a 40th anniversary thing planned.
Okay.
But, you know, we're definitely going to keep doing stuff. I mean, I don't know what it'll be yet. But I think there's it's sort of a back burner thing that we do occasionally put out little packages.
Yeah, right.
For those youngsters who haven't yet been introduced to the band, you know, we maybe will come up with a repackaging that's sort of like, here's your sampler of They Might Be Giants. We did one of those.
We
did a box called Dial a Song.
Well, Dial a Song, of course. Like, this is a almost infamous thing that you guys did.
And the 40th anniversary of Dial a Song will be in 2023. So,
okay. So you're aware of the milestones. You are whimsical enough to be cognizant that these milestones are forthcoming.
Yes.
Well, yes. I hope you do end up doing, first of all, I hope you end up doing shows in Canada, because we're not seeing that yet. We're starting to see bands touring.
No. Yeah. Although recently we did our very, was it 2018? We did our very first all Canada tour, and that was great. That went really well. And,
nice.
And we actually had never played Winnipeg before.
Oh.
And so, or Edmonton or any of those places. So that was really fun.
Nice.
And that worked out well. So I'm sure we'll be back for more of that.
You know, we were talking about your talk show appearances on Conan and Letterman earlier. I feel neglectful, because I will say I have a soft spot for the band because I'm a huge fan of the Larry Sanders Show.
Oh, yeah.
You guys were – I have a soft spot for almost every musical guest that ever did the show, because for those who don't know, the Larry Sanders Show was a fake TV talk show, and it was really innovative on many levels. It was like the dawn. It was really like you should check out the show. And anyway, so the musical performances were not whole. So the band would be playing, but then there would be scenes from the actual show kind of interspersed between the song, dialogue and stuff going on. What was that experience like? Do you have any recollection or fond memory of doing that in particular?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's funny you bring that up because the main thing I recall is that the cutaway to our performance was Scott Thompson saying something positive about us to Larry Sanders. And I'd met Scott years earlier when we did Conan. We were on Conan at the same time as him. And we realized that we were not only had the same birthday, but we were actually born on the same day.
Oh, wow.
So we had a whole conversation and he was telling me about his experience. Oddly, he just brought up the fact that his mother had a twin and how what an odd thing that was. I mean, not to him, obviously, that is, he had an identical twin to his mother. And
his aunt was like his mother. That's weird.
Yeah. So I got to say hello to him again Well, the other thing about that show was I lost my voice, but luckily I wasn't the one singing the the song. And I recall that Mr. Thompson had a, and I now I can't remember what it was, but he had some cold remedy that he was recommending. Because I had laryngitis because I'd been sick.
Like a honey? Was it like a Manuka honey or something?
It was something like that.
Yeah. So Scott and I have become friendly over the last few years, and he's been on this show 3 or 4 times. I'm a big fan of his and the Kids in the Hall. And we actually did a thing where I double-purposed a magazine piece with Scott where it was like a questionnaire. Uh-huh. And for some reason, and normally those things, they're not my favorite. They weren't ever my favorite assignment because people were like, I don't know. There was set questions, right? I couldn't just, but I would follow up with them after they said whatever they said, and that led to interesting stuff. Anyway, oddly enough, it's one of the most profound interactions I've ever had with anyone was Scott Thompson of Kids in the Hall answering this questionnaire and talking about how we should all, like one of the things he said was we should all know about every single religion rather than saying, you know, my religion is good, these ones are bad. Know them all cold, so you know where people are coming from, because that is one of our major sort of sources of polarization and teams. He said it, and I was like, right away, I'm like, you know, I don't know enough about religions. I feel unlearned. I've always avoided it because I felt like it was tearing us apart more than bringing us together. And
that's really interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, that's so fascinating. That's what I mean. Scott's just a very brilliant, funny, sweet person. So I'm happy you had that interaction.
Yes.
Anyway,
we have the exact same birthday. You should bear in mind.
Maybe
that reflects on me well. if you like Scott, you'll like me.
I feel like I've learned profound things from this conversation. Yeah. No. Absolutely. You're both very profound. John, in order to direct people to learn more about your band and this book, book the record and book the book. It's very confusing.
Yes.
It's confusing to say. I never found it confusing until I just said that.
I mean, I'm recalling that. I don't know if you remember this, but ABBA had a movie called Movie.
Oh yes, I do.
And then,
yeah.
And then they, and I think that it was called The Movie. And then they had a companion album, which was called The Album.
Right.
So I guess this is sort of in that tradition.
Reminds me of all the merchandising and Spaceballs. Remember the movie Spaceballs?
I do remember the movie. I don't remember the merchandise.
It was just like Spaceballs the book, Spaceballs the water softener. Okay, I can't remember all the product. It was just a product line thing. It was a joke. Anyway, sorry. If people want to learn more about They Might Be Giants and book, can you think of where to direct them on the internet?
Yes. Yes, they can go to depeshemode.com.
Is that what did you buy their domain? Is that how that works, or are they just helping you out?
That's a stock joke that Mr. Flansburgh made up that I just trot out whenever asked the same question. But I have to credit him; it was his jape.
Yeah.
You just go. Just type "They Might Be Giants" into the browser window, and you'll find us.
Okay.
There we are.
Okay.
There's several different ways to check us out.
Are you in particular, or you with the band, are you active on social media per se?
I am not, although I occasionally lurk, but I don't have a Facebook persona or any of those things. So I try and stay au courant. I try to find out what's going on, but I don't feel like I have anything interesting to say that I want to have to commit to on social media. You know.
This is an interesting thing to say after spending an hour with me talking. That's funny.
This is me talking. You know, I suppose the thing is we do have a presence that is for the purpose of promoting our project. So that's what I'm doing
that's
here.
That's true.
You know.
Yeah, that's true. Well, now I'm offended. That's all this is to you? You're using me? I didn't realize that,
right.
John. I thought we had something special. Just kidding. No, but they might be Giants has some sort of social media presence. Is that fair?
We do. We've got all the things. We have a Facebook account. We have a Twitter account. We have a Instagram.
You got it all.
We got all of them. I don't know what they are, but we have them.
I think those are most of them. As far as I know, those are most of them. Okay. Well, so book is going to be out in a matter of days, October 29th, 2021. If we can go out on a song from the record so people get a sense of what we've been talking about, I wonder, A, can you choose a song for us to play? And B, can you tell us why it came to mind?
So I guess the question is, I'm sorry, this in my ignorance, is this a podcast that has a Canadian theme because no, you're saying no. Okay. All right. Cause I would have suggested If Day for Winnipeg, if that were the case, but we could play the other song we discussed, Synopsis for Latecomers. Cause it's an unusual, maybe that's a bad example because it doesn't sound like a lot of what we do. I don't, why don't you choose one? I don't know.
You don't want to choose. You started to choose and then you bailed. Well, the show is based in Canada. I am in Alberta, which is relatively close to Manitoba. Yeah, If Day for Winnipeg could be the thing. I know that my wife really enjoys I Can't Remember the Dream, which has a nice video for it well. But I don't want to.
That's more. Yeah.
We're getting.
That's more like a single.
Yeah, we're getting into focus group territory here, you and I, John. And I feel like maybe we should just go with If Day for Winnipeg since we did discuss it and it has a Canadian content aspect to it. What do you think?
That's an excellent choice. I would go for that, Vish.
Okay. I appreciate this. This is excellent new music from an excellent new record called Book by They Might Be Giants. This is If Day for Winnipeg. John, thank you so much for making time for me. This was such a pleasure for me. I hope you enjoyed it and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
I did. Thank you, Vish. It was a pleasure.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, thank you very much for listening, and thanks again to John Linnell of They Might Be Giants for appearing on this, the 646th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcast. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it and it's not on any of the podcast platforms that you use there, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkhanna.com. Or go to DepecheMode.com. There's probably some interesting stuff there, too. You can like Creative Control on Facebook. You can follow the show on Twitter, at Vish Creative, or follow me directly on Twitter or on Instagram, at Vish Khanna. Also, please visit Patreon.com/Creative Control to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. You heard John and I talking about patrons in the olden days. Well, there are still patrons today. And for me, they exist on Patreon, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Now, $6 or more a month from you grants you access to exclusive content. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, please message me on Patreon and I will get you one just as soon as is humanly possible and while supplies last and as soon as I can get to the postal outlet here in Edmonton, which... I'm a little backlogged here. If you're owed a shirt and you haven't gotten it yet, it's only been a couple of weeks. Get off my back. I got your order. Now I'm just talking to one guy, and this feels weird. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, too, to Jim Guthrie. He lends me some music for his show. He's a beautiful... A small man. He's small in stature. He's only like 3 feet tall, but he's got a lot of music in him. And you can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. He's taller than 3 feet. I was just making a joke. And so what if he was 3 feet tall? Has he ever been in my pocket? Yes, but not the way I just described. Anyway, jimguthrie.org for more information. I owe Jim a call now. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with John Linnell of They Might Be Giants. Maybe that's what happened. I went small because the band is giant. Yeah, thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll check out Book by the band. It's great. The book and the record are both fantastic, and if you like what you heard today, please subscribe to Creative Control on the podcast thing you use or follow it and tell your friends to do the same, maybe, or ask them. Don't tell them. Don't tell your friends what to do. They'll resent you. Just ask them to do what you do and spread the word about the show, and that's all I've got. I thank you. Talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.